The Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening and welcome to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio on this beautiful sunny Sunday. It's very nice weather outside. We've just been sitting in a pub for a little bit, enjoying the weather.
I'm enjoying getting to the studio in daylight.
Oh, it's nice, isn't it?
Nice
and
novelty.
Also being able to leave when it's still a little bit light is nice as well. Coming up on the show this evening for you, we have an essay by my friend Corey Holes, who's a great writer, a very funny essay. We've also, if you were listening last week, we've got part two of The Whistling Room by Matt Boothman, who joins us in the studio.
Read by me, not written
read,
by me.
Well, yeah, read by Matt, who's joining us, and he'll be doing a film review for us in a couple of minutes. Also in the studio, we'd like to welcome Vicky Weston.
Hello, everybody.
Vicky's here to do a live rendition of the Blackshaw Arts Thing of the Week, which is pretty exciting for us. Normally, Vicky's not here, but Ellie is live tweeting the first rehearsal of Alice in Wonderland tonight. So if you want to follow what's happening at rehearsals for Alice in Wonderland, you can find us on Twitter at Blackshaw Update. But we're going to start the show with this.
The Matt Boothman film review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
Matt, we had a little bit of a debate last week about what we were going to actually be talking about, and we didn't really get anywhere. But you've made a decision.
Yeah, it came down to what was good timing on the night and what I was in the mood for, and what I was in the mood for in the end was Fast and Furious 7.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Highbrow cinema.
Absolutely. So you two have both seen at least Fast and Furious 1, right?
Yeah.
Correct.
I think so. Yeah. I have a terrible recollection for film, but we'll go with yes.
Did either of you think when you saw that movie that this would run to a 7 movie franchise?
No, it's like that joke in Back to the Future about Jaws 11 or whatever it is, but in real life.
Yeah. So I'm genuinely impressed that it's got to this many movies when it's not a sort of a planned series in the same vein as sort of Star Wars or Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit or anything like that. You know, those are the only other franchises that really come to mind that have run to this many movies. Whereas this wasn't planned, they just kept making more when the previous one made money and when there was fan demand and that kind of stuff. Now, one of the things that means is that it's got a bit soapy along the years. I tweeted out, and I think Blackshaw has retweeted as well, if anybody wants to catch up on what's been going on in the previous 6 movies, there's an instructive and also very entertaining catch-up video on YouTube. Just check at Matt Boothman on Twitter or at Blackshaw Update on Twitter for the link to that, which you don't need it to explain the setup or the sort of the scenario of the film because it is not complicated. But it is helpful to get a quick refresher on who wants revenge on whom and why Michelle Rodriguez's character is back from the dead and has amnesia and all those other sort of soapy series points. So like I say, it's not that the setup of this movie is not as complex as the backstory that it is building on. It's basically a revenge flick with a caper movie in the middle. So Jason Statham is the bad guy. He wants revenge on the whole Fast and Furious team. He's already killed one of them, and therefore they want revenge on him as well. So everybody's revenging on each other. But Jason Statham's character is a special forces. He's a spook. They keep saying, we're told over and over again throughout this movie, this guy is a ghost. He's undetectable. You'll never find him. Jason Statham does not get through a single scene in this movie without blowing something up. I have no idea.
That is classic Statham, though, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. So there's a whole... They have to find the thing that will be the hacking program that will help them track him down. So there's an excuse for a heist movie in the middle of this as well. But it's basically everybody wants to kill everybody else. Let's go at it in our cars. I really like Jason Statham. I think he's a great villain in this. He picks his projects well. I don't know whether it's him or whether he's just got a good agent, but I think he always he knows the kind of movies that he ought to be in. Like, stuff that doesn't take itself too seriously, that lets him show off sort of his hand-to-hand fighting abilities and all that kind of stuff. The whole movie is that kind of unsubtle and not very intelligent thing. So the whole, he's undetectable, but he blows everything up. The whole movie is kind of that contradiction.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of logic to the plot. The dialogue is pretty terrible throughout quite a lot of it. The Rock gets most of the bad lines. Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Of course he does.
Yeah.
It's classic Rock.
Yeah. I don't actually know whether it's that he gets the worst lines or whether he's just the worst at pulling them off.
Maybe just terrible
delivery.
Maybe
a combination of both.
It could be a combination of the two.
Yeah.
But the whole thing is it's self-aware. It like Statham, the movie knows what it is. It knows what it's trying to be. It knows what the fans want. It's really fun. And the camera work is just frenetic. Like every time they go to a new location, you get all these sort of smash cuts and snap pans and all the... Like the person behind the camera is going, look at this! Look at this! Look at this! Look at this other thing!
So
unfortunately, every time they go to a new location, what the camera is mostly telling them to look at is, like, women in bikinis soaping down calves.
Mm.
So there is a lot of that as well. So that is less fun.
Is it?
I think it probably is.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I got the feeling that it was... That almost felt like an obligation to the filmmakers, that like there was a lot of that in the first movie, and so they had to sort of pay homage to that. Because there is that Michelle Rodriguez's character calls out a couple of her male colleagues at one point for being similarly sort of pervy towards another character. So I feel like the people making the film understand that it is not okay, but
yeah,
they sort of do it anyway. So it's kind of the irony defense. It's not really excusable, but I feel like
they're aware of it.
They're sort of throwing it in because they feel they have to, rather than because they're really invested in it.
Okay,
that stuff. And what they are really invested in is the stunts.
Yeah.
I'm not a petrol head. I couldn't tell you what any of the cars in this movie are, or I even kind of pick them out of a lineup later on. But I do appreciate kind of crazy action in movies, and there's lots of kind of, you know, cars zooming really, really close to each other, and somebody jumps out of the window of one into the window of the other. And if I've got a criticism, it's that all of the best stunts are in the publicity material. They're in all the trailers and sort of the TV spots and the previews on YouTube. So I'd seen most of them already.
Mm-hmm.
But what it does do is it's for a stupid action movie, it's got a pretty decent grasp of character, and it balances its ensemble pretty well. And so it does that thing that most action movies fall down on, which is that you do actually care about the people doing the stunts, and therefore you get more invested in them and more excited by them. Obviously, the two cars sort of zooming past each other is not exciting unless you're actually worried about the people in them. And so most of these characters I've only seen the first Fast and the Furious. And this one, so I haven't seen any of the ones in the middle. So
really bookended it.
Yeah,
haven't you?
I really have. And so there's lots of characters in this one that I was not familiar with, but it's quite good at sort of introducing them quickly with economy, so you get to know kind of who they are, and you're like, okay, he's that guy, he's the techie geeky guy, and we'll build on that throughout. So I think overall it's gone from a B movie origin to blockbuster budgets, but
yeah,
it's got those higher budgets without really, I don't think it's lost its kind of B-movie values.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's still about kind of the ensemble and the family and the characters and all of that stuff, and it's still about the it's still kind of dumb and entertaining, but it hasn't done what, you know, it's not one of these giant budget blockbusters like Transformers, where it's just all action and you don't care about anything that's going on. It does seem to have kept some of its charm from earlier on in the series.
I think that's probably because it's at 7 now as well, because it's got this huge following of people that are really anticipating the next film coming out, and especially this one as well, with Paul Walker passing away before it sort of finished filming. I think it's really, it's a really funny series of films that you just, like we were saying before, you don't expect it to be at no. seven, and it's because of the following, and it's because of, you know, people, like, I think it came out when I was probably in grade eight, and when Paul Walker passed away, everyone was devastated, and it was all centered around, oh my God, he's the guy from Fast and Furious, and that was where he was really known from. So I think it's an interesting set of films. Not a set of films that I'm particularly that interested in myself.
I think it's interesting to note also that it's done this well, and Paul Walker is the only member of the kind of the main core cast who's a white guy, and he was kind of the main character in the first one, but it's become much more of an ensemble piece since then. And it's quite nice to see. I think it's only him, Jason Statham and Kurt Russell are the sort of main speaking white guys, and it's a big enough ensemble that they're actually in the minority, which is not usual in a big Hollywood blockbuster at all.
Yeah.
So I think it's great that it's doing well.
I wonder if also, I know that Vin Diesel and Paul Walker, who were in the original film and who have continued to be in the films subsequently, had a really, really close relationship, like best friends. And I do wonder if that somehow contributes to the kind of quality of the character that you get coming across on film, if you've got that really, really strong relationship, which I assume probably does have an impact on the rest of the cast as well, which makes them feel like they're, you know, this close-knit family off-screen, which kind of translates to that on-screen, which, you know, contributes to making it more believable.
It's interesting that they've obviously done some edits, especially to the end of the movie, to sort of pay tribute to Paul Walker. And there is quite a sort of, if you know the context and what's gone on, there is quite a moving moment at the end where they all sort of say goodbye. But actually, Vin Diesel's main relationship in this installment is with Michelle Rodriguez's character, who's coming back after everybody thought she was dead, and now she's got amnesia because of various things that happened in previous movies. So Vin Diesel and Paul Walker don't act, like, their relationship is not central to this movie, but it is. They have put, so Paul Walker's arc in it is all about whether he's getting out of the game and whether he's settling down. So they clearly acknowledged, we need to do something for the fans about the fact that he's not going to be in them anymore. We want to give him a good send-off.
I like this discussion because I came into this review as being like, oh, I'm not going to enjoy this, and you're not going to talk me over into wanting to go and see it. But I came in with the vibe that babes, cars, dudes, heist situations really sell, and that's what has, you know, made these films so successful. But I don't think that it's that, having this conversation. I think it's the cast ensemble kind of, you know, family. Everyone's really anticipating the next one, and I think that's really nice. Yeah. And it makes the film a little bit, it fleshes it out a little bit more in the terms of it's not just a car stunt movie for dudes.
No, I mean, it is still a stupid popcorn movie, and it doesn't make much sense. And like I say, the dialogue is bad, and all of those flaws I've mentioned. But yeah,
but it does overcome it, I think. In listening to you speak about it, like, you know, it doesn't make sense, and some of the acting is questionable.
Yeah,
but still,
I can tolerate dumb, but I can't tolerate being bored, and I wasn't bored.
Yeah, well, I think that's, I mean, in past reviews we've had, you know, I was not that bored in Jupiter Ascending, but I still hated it. It's action. Action always, you know, sort of gets you past, gets you through the hour and a half that you're sitting there. Well, thanks, Matt.
I think I
liked that review. You talked me around to liking the series of Fast and the Furious. Next week, what are you thinking?
I'm not here next week, I'm afraid, no.
Matt's leaving us in the lurch for a movie review. I was actually thinking that maybe, Vix, if you want to, we could maybe go, like, delve into the past and do an old
film. Oh, yeah, I would love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, there's a new Kurt Cobain documentary that's just come out as well, which I'm thinking of watching, which might happen in the next...
If it happens in the next week, that's what we'll be talking about.
Yeah,
otherwise,
exactly.
Something else.
Otherwise, something old.
Unless I manage to make it to the cinema in one of the free evenings I have this week.
It's not that much out, that's the problem.
It is a bit of a problem. So we might do a
wasteland.
I'm thinking about a Nicolas Cage retrospective in 10
about
minutes.
Yeah.
Basically, I'm only taking next weekend off because I want to avoid having to see Paul Blart Mall Cop 2.
Yes, fair play. No one would criticise you for that.
It's, there's terrible choices out there. So thank you very much, Matt, for your fantastic film review. The next thing coming up this evening is an essay by my friend Corey Holes, who is a writer. This essay has a very, very long title. It's quite entertaining. He starts off speaking about how fantastic 1999 was in terms of films and art and all the amazing people that were making and creating things.
You were reeling off the list of movies that came out in 1999
to me. Oh my goodness,
it is crazy.
It's an amazing list. If you want to look up 1999, we might post a link to an IMDb 1999 list of films that came out in that year. It is mind-blowing. It's very, very interesting. Anyway, this essay is called Sex, Drugs, No Hat, No Play. The warts and all story of how a bunch of fifth graders were impervious to the power of intra-band politics, despite never coming together to play a single note.
1999 was an amazing year for pop culture and creativity. It is perhaps one of the single greatest years in terms of films being released of all time, with too many titles of note to name, not limited to, but including Being John Malkovich, Fight Club, The Matrix, Three Kings, and many, many more, pleasing cinemagoers and critics alike. This was mirrored by a significant uptick in terrific albums of incredible scope. These albums from bands like Blur, The Flaming Lips, Outkast, Beck, Tom Waits, D'Angelo, Radiohead, and PJ Harvey are still as relevant today as they were all those years ago. 1999 was a special time, because these were creative people, passionate people, who were making inspired art that saw positive responses from large reaches of the general populace. In fact, in the film industry, the year and indeed the latter portion or post-Titanic portion of the decade was dominated purely by creative visionaries who were steadfast in their ideals when it came to what they wanted to express, and despite being revered for their films, were admonished from a personal perspective. In the novel Rebels on the Backlot, an account of the time, which details the rapid rise of the maverick screenwriter directors of the time, many of them are referred to somewhat horrifically. David Fincher is referred to consistently as Doberman Fincher. Quentin Tarantino is painted as a power-mad flake who cut ties with anyone who didn't directly serve his ascension. Paul Thomas Anderson is portrayed as an arrogant egomaniac who cares about his film's final cut more than any one person or relationship. And the less said about the goings-on about George Clooney and David O. Russell's crazed power games and physical alterations on the set of Three Kings, the better. As an aside, the book also features an anecdote featuring what I can only assume is the greatest note from a studio of all time. When hearing about Meatloaf's busty Bob character in Fight Club, the studio heads asked Fincher in an urgent front office note, "Do the breasts have to have nipples?" But I digress. However, while many may speculate as to the reasons behind the director's actions, or indeed whether or not the interviews sourced in the book were embellished, heard secondhand, or the subjects had ulterior motives, one simply cannot argue with the results. For whatever reason, these passionate people got together, had many issues, but due to some beautiful reason, allowed art and artfulness to ultimately triumph. Whether as a biological fear that the world was ending, or some other strange mystical reason, all of these great creators heard this otherworldly mystical call around the turn of the millennium, put aside their differences, and created time capsules that literally stand as a testament to what the human race can achieve and create. Unfortunately, though, for a young group of six children in Malvern, Victoria, Australia, not everyone made it through this passionate and creative time unscathed. We were aware that something pretty special was happening. We had seen The Matrix. Will Smith had sent us a chilling but still pretty chill warning that the decade was coming to a close, that it was time for a new millennium. A change was coming. We all felt the creative call, and we were there to accept the charges. So we begun a band. Tim, Tom M, Rennie, Corey, Tom B, Ben. We had a unique mix of simplistic names and enough of an esoteric twist that would give the marketing team a bit to chew on. Besides, the Spice Girls had already shown us that having two people with the same name with a single syllable difference is a guaranteed winner. All you really need at the start is a name. That's what we thought anyway. And we already knew how successful we would be. I remember we had to do a project in math class as soon as we had picked the name. We had to choose how we would spend $1 million, presumably to show how we worked down from a high number to zero. But that's not the point of the project, or it wasn't for me at the time. I was getting ready for the months ahead when we broke. This was real life. We didn't choose the name chose us. It's like it somehow appeared in all of our heads at the same moment. From that moment on, we were the All-Stars. Why? Because we were, of course. and you'd better believe we drafted up our first album cover and band logo immediately. And if you had to ask yourself, for more than a second, if the letter A in All in Stars was an actual star, then maybe you're thinking of a different goddamn band. By Friday recess, it was all anyone could talk about. I had a computer at the time with Windows 95 and mainly spent my time on Encarta and Age of Empires, but I'm pretty sure I made the point to Tom M that the All-Stars were blog hot right now. We're flying high. As is the danger, though, with high flight comes the possibility of going a little too close to the sun. Between recess and lunch, as self-appointed band leader and chief songwriter, I took it upon myself to get some of our material down on paper. I enlisted the help of a songwriter, Tristan, without band approval. But why did I need it? There would be nothing without me. We nutted out our first surefire hit, Nightclub, which included the refrain, "At the nightclub, it is the place to be," which is not only a bit of a harbinger of some of the Black Eyed Peas' later songs, but also 100% guesswork from a 9-year-old child who still really enjoyed Pokemon. That lunchtime proved to be a dark time for the All-Stars. In fact, we proved to be somewhat eponymous, but not in the way that we would have liked. In fact, we seemed to collapse inward on each other like a neutron star, all in the space of a single hour. Firstly, there was the drum debacle. We had 3 members threaten to quit, as they were not able to be the musical group's sole drummer. Tim politely reasoned that he, in fact, was the only member with a drum kit, and any ability on the kit, and therefore should perhaps get the role. But Rennie and Tom B still both laid claim to the stool like it was the Iron Throne of Westeros. While I tried to mediate this, the news had spread like wildfire that I had hired someone into the band to be a songwriter. Basically, by this point, not being in the band was the popularity equivalent of kicking the football over the fence accidentally at recess. So many of my friends and acquaintances came up to me asking to be in the band. Several people, in fact, came up and just started telling me some hard luck story about themselves and then singing, only for me to call them talentless and tell them I had better things to do. What I'm saying is, I invented the X Factor accidentally, and Simon Cowell owes me a lot of money. Eventually, after my round of open auditions, I complained to my bandmates about this fact. I let it slip about my recent hire, and they were incensed with my actions, purely as they would see a diminishing cut of our first album sales. The band broke up on the spot, so we could make it on time to get changed for physical education class. It was all my fault. My arrogance and desire to create, like the directors in that golden age, was all-consuming. But the All-Stars were not strong enough to rise above my egomania and narcissism, and we failed to add our musical page to history. I remember reading an interview at the time featuring Taylor Hanson of Hanson, whereby he described his songwriting process at the time as almost entirely looking out the window and writing about what he saw. This was a revelatory lightbulb moment for me and led to what would have been our second and I am certain critically acclaimed single, Leaves on the Road. A year after our breakup, Rennie visited me at my house and I had the guitar out. We caught up on old times and he asked me, as I strummed along mournfully, "Remember when we were in a band?" I looked out the window as some loose leaves rolled slowly along the bitumen and I said, "I do. I remember the music."
That was Corey Holzer's essay entitled Sex, Drugs, No Hat, No Play, which spoke a little bit about the fantastic films and creativeness that happened in 1999 and then sort of rolled into him as a 9-year-old starting a band off of the back of that creativeness. We had a little bit of a discussion about what No Hat, No Play means, and I thought it's an Australian term. It basically means if you don't have your hat with you at school, you're not allowed to go outside into the sun. Because our sun burns you.
It's a lot more literal than I thought it might be.
Yeah.
Matt thought it was about something quite different, which was a bit concerning.
It's way less creepier that it's about actual hats and actual playtime.
Yeah. Yeah. Glad we cleared that one up.
Yeah.
If you would like to look at a list of all the films that were released in 1999, it's an incredible list. We've just tweeted a link to that from Blackshaw Update on Twitter. Now we've got a very exciting edition of Arts Thing of the Week, which is in studio this week. And Vicky is going to talk to us about books being turned into plays.
Correct. That is what I'm talking about. And the reason that I'm doing this is because on Tuesday night last week, I went to see Treasure Island at the National Theatre. It's just finished a run. It was absolutely incredible. This is partly because, and this is linked to what I'm going to talk about, Treasure Island is a really important book for me from my childhood. And by by the show being as brilliant as it was and as immersive as it was, I felt partly transported back to the 9-year-old reading Treasure Island for the first time. So that's sort of what I'm going to talk about. But I'm going to more just open it out to discussion pretty quickly instead of just ranting on for a bit. But I'm just going to tell you a bit about the show because it actually was incredible. And the main reason is because at the National, the capacity for the technical stuff they can do there is quite phenomenal. And they basically turned the entire stage into a revolving, magnificent ship / island with complete with like bubbling pustules of earth that people could like dive underneath. So Ben Gunn is like popping in and out of the physical island that is the stage, and it was just phenomenal. And they had these light bulbs hanging from the, like festoon lights hanging from the ceiling that they turned into the constellations of the stars when Long John Silver is talking to Jim Hawkins about how to navigate by the stars. And it was just phenomenal. And the lights and the sounds in the theatre, even though it is a really big a big auditorium, it really felt like you were just right there on the boat, on the island, and that was a kind of incredible experience. And it just reminded me that theatre has that really like transporting power that I think mostly with film you don't get the same experience. You can be really invested in the characters, as we were talking about earlier, but I don't know that it has that same sense of you really feeling like you're there with the characters in whatever location they're in. So that's just sort of what I wanted to talk about, was some of the really great adaptations that there have been from books to the stage, and how those are different from film adaptations, and if there are, and I think there are certain books that lend themselves particularly well to films, but then some books that lend themselves better to television series or even to theatre instead, and that particularly with something that's got a theatrical element already, such as Treasure Island, because obviously kind of the pirate theme is inherently theatrical, that translates I think so much better to the stage than to any other medium. So I was just going to ask if you guys have any like favourite plays you've been seeing, or even favourite films that have been adapted from books, where you feel like it's kind of enhancing the experience of reading the book in the first place.
See, I'm really rubbish at this conversation because I was trying to think of a single play that I've seen that's been adapted from a book, and I could only think of one, and it's one that we've done on this show, and it was Great Expectations, and I saw it at the start of the year, and I'd never read Great Expectations beforehand anyway. So I don't know, Matt, have you seen a play that was adapted from a book that you loved?
Yeah, a couple. So Belt Up Theatre's The Tartuffe, which is adapted from Moliere, was fantastic, and that was exactly what you're talking about with adaptations that are sort of inherently theatrical, because they're that company does very immersive stuff and involving the audience and sort of messing about and improvising really kind of got the anarchic spirit of the original, I think. I've seen a pretty good Jekyll and Hyde as well, although the name of the company escapes me, I'm afraid. It was at the Red Lion a couple of years ago. Similarly, with some quite nice sort of theatrical devices to it, rather than it just being kind of a straight plop it on the stage.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think going into books adapted for film as well, I think you're right, Vicky, in saying that it's not as powerful as seeing something on stage. And I wonder if that's because of the fact that you are so close to the action. And even though you can't do the same thing in what you can do with theatre and film, like film is, you know, all cut and, you know, there's loads of action and, you know, lots of stuff you could do with film, theatre can't do that so much, but it is more personable. And I think that really adds to seeing a book transformed into a play.
I'm definitely intrigued by Enda Walsh has adapted Roald Dahl's The Twits, and that's on at the Royal Court now, or is it about to start?
I can't remember, but it is. Yeah, I heard a thing about it, and then I thought to myself at the time, I must find out more about this because I want to go and see this. And then until you just mentioned it just now, I had totally forgotten about it.
I would love to see that.
Yeah. I think children's fiction often lends itself really well to the stage. So, you know, things by Roald Dahl, which are incredibly imaginative. I went to see a few years ago now an adaptation of Howl's Moving Castle, which, of course, was turned into what is an incredible film by Studio Ghibli. Like, it is a brilliant film, and the film adds so much to the book. But the stage adaptation, although it wasn't perfect, partly because it was very early in the run, it was at the Southwark Playhouse, it was still, like, the the relationship between Howl and the audience was really, really good. And you just don't get that in a film. Like, the actors can feed off what's happening in the audience.
Do you think that's why Panto works so well? Because it's adapted from a story. Well, I guess that is. Yeah. That's definitely why Panto works so well. It's adapted from a story that everyone loves and that has been passed down for so long. And you've got that immediacy with it just being right there on the stage for you.
I think, yeah, Panto does benefit from the notion that the audience already know what's going to happen and how it's going to end, and that they know what to do. Like, there are cues when the baddie walks on, you have this reaction. And actually, in some ways, Treasure Island was similar. Everyone knows Long John Silver is the baddie from the very beginning. We are not fooled by that.
Yeah.
You know, we are not in any. We're waiting for him to turn up, for him to reveal that he's the one-legged man, and for the characters on stage to be, or for Jim Hawkins to be saying, "Oh, he's got a one leg. He's one-legged man. Oh my gosh! Oh my gosh!" And then for him to get swept up. Or actually, just a quick point: in the Treasure Island at the National, Jim is actually a woman.
Really?
Is a girl, yeah. And it was fantastic. Additionally, for that reason, I thought it didn't change anything about her relationships with any of the other characters. It was just brilliant to see a girl character in a main part instead of a boy. It just worked. So, yeah.
Is Treasure Island running for much longer?
No, it's already finished, unfortunately. It's finished. But it does lead me on to an adaptation that we're doing at Battersea Library. Shameless plug here, guys. which, of course, is both children's fiction and an adaptation for the stage that's really immersive for the audience, and that is Alice in Wonderland, which will be starting on the 2nd of May as a part of Wandsworth Arts Fringe. And we just want to quickly talk about our competition that we're doing for tickets for that show.
I think we're going to, we might do it towards the end of the show, and we're going to tell you some of the submissions that we've had so far, and it's a competition that's running until next week, and we're going to reveal the winner next week. It's a competition for a family pass, so two adults and two children. But the next thing that we're going to quickly slide into is, if you're listening to the show last week, we played the first part of The Whistling Room, which is read by our lovely Matt Boothman, who's in the studio with us, and Matt is going to give us a little bit of a sort of rundown of what happened last week, and then we're going to go into part two.
So this is part two of The Whistling Room by William Hope Hodgson. In part one, Thomas Carnacki, the ghost finder, turned up at Ayastrae Castle and to investigate a haunting. There's a room that makes weird whistling sounds, and it's freaking everybody at the castle out. And he surveys the whole room, and I think where we left it last week, he's pretty much decided that it's not a trick. It's definitely a real supernatural haunting.
Fantastic. This is part two of The Whistling Room.
Feed the things outside. Maybe I'd better feed them now just to be safe. No, I'm pretty sure it was 15 times. The things need to learn to find their own food anyway. Why do I stay here with the things and the mind-bending vistas and the hidden horizons instead of out there with all of you? Well, I need the peace and quiet to write. That and the other thing. But that was a grave miscarriage of justice, ask anyone. Except the matriarch. She's biased. Regardless, I make the most of the peace and quiet. I have two tales published, two more wandering the exoplanar wilderness looking for a home, and another entering final draft stage. But what's taking up most of my time at the moment is my play, Audience with the Ghost Finder. Since I last talked to you, the first scene of Ghostfinder found its way over the hidden horizon and into a pub in London, England. It's the second time this has happened. I've been scrying to try and work out how, and all I can divine is one word, Blackshaw. However it happened, it was edifying. There's a lot of business in that opening scene, and judging the timing, how all the action interlocks with the dialogue, is next to impossible unless you've got a couple of chaps in waistcoats and braces actually performing the thing in front of you. I have copious notes for the next draft, though I need to write the first draft of the rest of the thing first. I've written up to the introduction of the widow Aster and her sceptical son, which means I'm not far off writing the first seriously spooky part. I think I'll have to wait until dark to get in the right mood. Meanwhile, here's the second part of The Whistling Room. I didn't have time to introduce this one properly last time. It's the first Carnacki the Ghostfinder story I came across. The podcastle drifted past my window one evening and murmured it to me. If not for that event, I wouldn't be writing this play at all. So I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. This is part two of The Whistling Room, a tale of Carnacki the Ghostfinder by William Hope Hodgson.
All this time, every night, and sometimes most of the night, the hooning whistling of the room was intolerable. It was as if an intelligence there knew that steps were being taken against it and piped and hooned in a sort of mad, mocking contempt. I tell you, it was as extraordinary as it was horrible. Time after time I went along, tiptoeing noiselessly on stockinged feet to the sealed door, for I always kept the room sealed. I went at all hours of the night, and often the whistling inside would seem to change to a brutally malignant note, as though the half-animate monster saw me plainly through the shut door. And all the time, the shrieking, hooning whistling would fill the whole corridor, so that I used to feel a precious lonely chap messing about in there with one of hell's mysteries. And every morning I would enter the room and examine the different hairs and seals. You see, after the first week I had stretched parallel hairs across all the walls of the room and along the ceiling, but over the floor, which was of polished stone, I had set out little colourless wafers, tacky side uppermost. Each wafer was numbered, and they were arranged after a definite plan, so that I should be able to trace the exact movements of any living thing that went across the floor. You will see that no material being or creature could possibly have entered that room without leaving many signs to tell me about it. But nothing was ever disturbed, and I began to think that I should have to risk an attempt to stay the night in the room in the electric pentacle. Yet, mind you, I knew that it would be a crazy thing to do, but I was getting stumped and ready to do anything. Once about midnight I did break the seal on the door and have a quick look in, but, I tell you, the whole room gave one mad yell and seemed to come towards me in a great belly of shadows, as if the walls had bellied in toward me. Of course, that must have been fancy. Anyway, the yell was sufficient, and I slammed the door and locked it, feeling a bit weak down my spine. You know the feeling. And then, when I had got to that state of readiness for anything, I made something of a discovery. It was about 1 in the morning, and I was walking slowly round the castle, keeping in the soft grass. I had come under the shadow of the east front, and far above me I could hear the vile, hooning whistle of the room, up in the darkness of the unlit wing. Then, suddenly, a little in front of me I heard a man's voice, speaking low, but evidently in glee. "By George, you chaps! But I wouldn't care to bring a wife home in that," it said, in the tone of the cultured Irish. Someone started to reply, but there came a sharp exclamation and then a rush, and I heard footsteps running in all directions. Evidently the men had spotted me. For a few seconds I stood there, feeling an awful ass. After all, they were at the bottom of the haunting. Do you see what a big fool it made me seem? I had no doubt but that they were some of Tassock's rivals, and here I had been feeling in every bone that I had hit a real bad, genuine case. And then, you know, there came the memory of hundreds of details that made me just as much in doubt again. Anyway, whether it was natural or abnatural, there was a great deal yet to be cleared up. I told Tassock next morning what I had discovered, and through the whole of every night for 5 nights we kept a close watch round the east wing. But there was never a sign of anyone prowling about, and all the time, almost from evening to dawn, that grotesque whistling would hoon incredibly far above us in the darkness. On the morning after the 5th night, I received a wire from here which brought me home by the next boat.
I explained to Tassock that I was simply bound to come away for a few days, but told him to keep up the watch round the castle. One thing I was very careful to do, and that was to make him absolutely promise never to go into the room between sunset and sunrise. I made it clear to him that we knew nothing definite yet one way or the other, and if the room were what I had first thought it to be, it might be a lot better to him to die first than to enter it after dark. When I got here and had finished my business, I thought you chaps would be interested, and also I wanted to get it all spread out clear in my mind, so I rung you up. I am going over again tomorrow, and when I get back I ought to have something pretty extraordinary to tell you. By the way, there is a curious thing I forgot to tell you. I tried to get a phonographic record of the whistling, but it simply produced no impression on the wax at all. That is one of the things that has made me feel queer, I can tell you. Another extraordinary thing is that the microphone will not magnify the sound, will not even transmit it, seems to take no account of it and acts as if it was non-existent. I am absolutely and utterly stumped up to the present. I am a wee bit curious to see whether any of your dear clever heads can make daylight of it. I cannot. Not yet. He rose to his feet. Good night, all, he said, and began to usher us out abruptly, but without offence, into the night. A fortnight later he dropped each of us a card, and you can imagine that I was not late this time. When we arrived, Carnacki took us straight to dinner, and when we had finished and all made ourselves comfortable, he began again, where he had left off. Now, just listen quietly, for I have got something pretty queer to tell you. I got back late at night, and I had to walk up to the castle, as I had not warned them that I was coming. It was bright moonlight, so that the walk was rather a pleasure than otherwise. When I got there, the whole place was in darkness, and I thought I would take a walk round outside to see whether Tassock or his brother was keeping watch. But I could not find them anywhere, and concluded that they had got tired of it and gone off to bed. As I returned across the front of the east wing, I caught the hooning whistling of the room, coming down strangely through the stillness of the night. It had a queer note in it, I remember, low and constant, queerly meditative. I looked up at the window, bright in the moonlight, and got a sudden thought to bring a ladder from the stable yard and try to get a look into the room through the window. With this notion I hunted round at the back of the castle among the straggle of offices, and presently found a long, fairly light ladder, though it was heavy enough for one, goodness knows. And I thought at first that I should never get it reared. I managed at last, and let the ends rest very quietly against the wall, a little below the sill of the larger window. Then, going silently, I went up the ladder. Presently, I had my face above the sill and was looking in alone with the moonlight. Of course, the queer whistling sounded louder up there, but it still conveyed that peculiar sense of something whistling quietly to itself, can you understand? Though, for all the meditative lowness of the note, the horrible gargantuan quality was distinct. A mighty parody of the human, as if I stood there and listened to the whistling from the lips of a monster with a man's soul. And then, you know, I saw something. The floor in the middle of the huge empty room was puckered upward in the centre into a strange soft-looking mound, parted at the top into an ever-changing hole that pulsated to that great gentle hooning. At times, as I watched, I saw the heaving of the indented mound gap across with a queer inward suction, as with the drawing of an enormous breath. Then the thing would dilate and pout once more to the incredible melody. And suddenly, as I stared, dumb, it came to me that the thing was living. I was looking at two enormous blackened lips, blistered and brutal, there in the pale moonlight. Abruptly, they bulged out to a vast pouting mound of force and sound, stiffened and swollen, and hugely massive and clean-cut in the moonbeams. And a great sweat lay heavy on the vast upper lip. In the same moment of time, the whistling had burst into a mad screaming note that seemed to stun me, even where I stood outside of the window. And then, the following moment, I was staring blankly at the solid, undisturbed floor of the room, smooth, polished stone flooring from wall to wall, and there was an absolute silence. You can picture me staring into the quiet room and knowing what I knew. I felt like a sick, frightened kid and wanted to slide quietly down the ladder and run away. But in that very instant I heard Tassock's voice calling to me from within the room for help. Help! My God, but I got such an awful dazed feeling. and I had a vague, bewildered notion that, after all, it was the Irishmen who had got him in there and were taking it out of him. And then the call came again, and I burst the window and jumped in to help him. I had a confused idea that the call had come from within the shadow of the great fireplace, and I raced across to it, but there was no one there. "Tassock!" I shouted, and my voice went empty-sounding round the great apartment. And then, in a flash, I knew that Tassock had never called. I whirled round, sick with fear, toward the window, and as I did so, a frightful, exultant, whistling scream burst through the room. On my left, the end wall had bellied in toward me in a pair of gargantuan lips, black and utterly monstrous to within a yard of my face. I fumbled for a mad instant at my revolver, not for it, but myself, for the danger was 1,000 times worse than death. And then, suddenly, the unknown last line of the Sa-Ma ritual was whispered quite audibly in the room. Instantly, the thing happened that I have known once before. There came a sense as of dust falling continually and monotonously, and I knew that my life hung uncertain and suspended for a flash in a brief reeling vertigo of unseeable things. Then that ended, and I knew that I might live. My soul and body blended again, and life and power came to me. I dashed furiously at the window and hurled myself out head foremost, for I can tell you that I had stopped being afraid of death. I crashed down onto the ladder and slithered, grabbing and grabbing, and so came some way or other alive to the bottom. And there I sat in the soft wet grass, with the moonlight all about me, and far above, through the broken window of the room, there was a low whistling. That is the chief of it. I was not hurt, and I went round to the front and knocked Tassock up. When they let me in, we had a long yarn over some good whisky, for I was shaken to pieces, and I explained things as much as I could. I told Tassock that the room would have to come down, and every fragment of it burned in a blast furnace erected within a pentacle. He nodded. There was nothing to say. Then I went to bed. We turned a small army onto the work, and within 10 days that lovely thing had gone up in smoke, and what was left was calcined and clean. It was when the workmen were stripping the panelling that I got hold of a sound notion of the beginnings of that beastly development. Over the great fireplace, after the great oak panels had been torn down, I found that there was let into the masonry a scrollwork of stone, with on it an old inscription in ancient Celtic, that here in this room was burned Dian Tian Se, jester of King Alzof, who made the Song of Foolishness upon King Ernor of the Seventh Castle. When I got the translation clear, I gave it to Tassock. He was tremendously excited, for he knew the old tale, and took me down to the library to look at an old parchment that gave the story in detail. Afterward, I found that the incident was well known about the countryside, but always regarded more as a legend than as history. And no one ever seemed to have dreamt that the old east wing of Ayastre Castle was the remains of the ancient Seventh Castle. From the old parchment I gather that there had been a pretty dirty job done away back in the years. It seems that King Alzof and King Ernor had been enemies by birthright, as you might say truly, but that nothing more than a little raiding had occurred on either side for years, until Dian Tian Se had made the Song of Foolishness upon King Ernor, and sang it before King Alzof, and so greatly was it appreciated that King Alzof gave the jester one of his ladies to wife. Presently, all the people of the land had come to know the song, and so it came at last to King Ernor, who was so angered that he made war upon his old enemy, and took and burned him and his castle. But Dian Tian Se, the jester, he brought with him to his own place, and having torn his tongue out because of the song which he had made and sung, he imprisoned him in the room in the east wing, which was evidently used for unpleasant purposes, and the jester's wife he kept for himself, having a fancy for her prettiness. But one night Dian Tian Se's wife was not to be found, and in the morning they discovered her lying dead in her husband's arms, and he sitting, whistling the Song of Foolishness, for he had no longer the power to sing it. Then they roasted Dian Tian Se in the great fireplace, probably from that self-same galley iron which I have already mentioned. And until he died, Dian Tian Se ceased not to whistle the Song of Foolishness, which he could no longer sing. But afterward, in that room there was often heard at night the sound of something whistling, and there grew a power in that room so that none dared to sleep in it, And presently, it would seem, the king went to another castle, for the whistling troubled him. There you have it all. Of course, that is only a rough rendering of the translation of the parchment, but it sounds extraordinarily quaint, don't you think so? Yes, I said, answering for the lot. But how did the thing grow to such a tremendous manifestation? One of those cases of continuity of thought producing a positive action upon the immediate surrounding material, replied Carnacki. The development must have been going forward through centuries to have produced such a monstrosity. It was a true instance of Saiti'i manifestation, which I can best explain by likening it to a living spiritual fungus, which involves the very structure of the ether fibre itself, and, of course, in so doing, acquires an essential control over the material substance involved in it. It is impossible to make it plainer in a few words. What broke the seventh hair? Asked Taylor. But Carnacki did not know. He thought it was probably nothing but being too severely tensioned. He also explained that they had found out that the men who had run away had not been up to mischief, but had come over secretly merely to hear the whistling, which indeed had suddenly become the talk of the whole countryside. One other thing, said Arkwright. Have you any idea what governs the use of the unknown last line of the Saamar ritual? I know, of course, that it was used by the abhuman priests in the incantation of Rai'i. But what used it upon your behalf, and what made it? You had better read Harzen's monograph and my addenda to it on astral and astral coordination and interference, said Carnacki. It is an extraordinary subject, and I can only say here that the human vibration may not be insulated from the astral, as is always believed to be the case in interferences by the abhuman, without immediate action being taken by those forces which govern the spinning of the outer circle. In other words, it is being proved time after time that there is some inscrutable protective force constantly intervening between the human soul, not the body, mind you, and the outer monstrosities. Am I clear? Yes, I think so, I replied. And you believe that the room had become the material expression of the ancient jester, that his soul, rotten with hatred, has bred into a monster, eh? I asked. Yes, said Carnacki, nodding. I think you've put my thought rather neatly. It is a queer coincidence that Miss Donoghue is supposed to be descended, so I have heard since, from the same King Ernor. It makes one think some curious thoughts, doesn't it? The marriage coming on, and the room waking to fresh life. If she had gone into that room ever, eh? It had waited a long time. Sins of the fathers. Yes, I've thought of that. They're to be married next week, and I am to be best man, which is a thing I hate. And he won his bets, rather. Just think, if ever she had gone into that room. Pretty horrible, eh? He nodded his head grimly, and we four nodded back. Then he stood and took us collectively to the door, and presently thrust us forth in friendly fashion on the embankment and into the fresh night air. Good night, we all called back, and went to our various homes. If she had, eh? If she had. That is what I kept thinking.
Next time you tune in, I'm going to take a break from Hodgson and read you something of mine. If you find yourself experiencing symptoms of withdrawal from Hodgson, visit Hodgecast, hodgecast.blogspot.com, where Paul Potts is narrating everything Hodgson has ever written. Administer as many episodes as it takes to quell the symptoms. Just don't forget to keep this frequency open.
You've been listening to MJ Starling's Exoplanar Frequency. Tune in again at mjstarling.com or subscribe using your podcatcher of choice so you'll never miss a transmission. Find me at facebook.com/Tokyo Safari or on Twitter at MJ Starling. The music you're hearing is Comfortable Mystery 4 by Kevin MacLeod. You can hear more of his music at incompetech.com. This transmission is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 unported license.
That was part two of The Whistling Room by our very lovely Matt Boothman, who comes in and does our film reviews for us. We're literally at the end of end of another episode of the Blackshaw Arts Hour this evening. You've heard a little bit of theatre, and we've heard an essay, and we're also going to talk a little bit to you about, very quickly, the competition that we're running as a part of Alice in Wonderland, which is our next upcoming Blackshaw production, which begins on, am I right in saying the 17th of May?
2nd of May.
Goes till the 17th of May. I got the end date right.
You did get the end date. Yay. So no one's going to, well, they would have missed most of it if they turned up on the 17th, but it's the 2nd.
I'm so terrible at promoting.
It's all right, because I know when the dates are, so it's, as long as one of us does, everything's fine.
I'm the button monkey.
Do you want to say what the competition is, or shall I do it?
I will say what the competition is. The competition is, you can win a pair of adult passes and a pair of children's passes to go and see our production of Alice in Wonderland if you tweet us at Blackshaw Update with your answer to why is a raven like a writing desk, which is involved in Alice in Wonderland, as you probably know. We have had 3 submissions so far. We're running this until next week. So on the show next week, we'll be announcing the winner of the 4 tickets. And Vicky, would you like to tell us what some of the submissions have been?
So one was from at Andrew C. Skipper, who said the answer was that they both have bills.
Which good.
It's a good answer.
Yep, that is a good answer.
At Wild Bear Elena said because Poe wrote on both.
Yeah, ooh, I like that one.
It's so subtextual, so much. It's so good. It's very literary. I'm loving it. And from at Scobez says, a raven is not like a writing desk. It's actually like her wardrobe. And you can't see this picture, but we will retweet it. And it's a picture of her wardrobe. And on it, it says, why is a raven like a writing desk?
That's
which
so
is
good.
Just incredible. It's pretty incredible.
So go to Twitter, tweet us why a raven is like a writing desk, and you could have the chance to win 4 tickets to our production of Alice in Wonderland. That is the end of the show. Thank you so much, Vicky, for coming in and presenting with me.
No worries. It was a great pleasure.
Tune in next week from 6 till 7. We'll be here again. This song coming up is called 1999 to go very well with our theme of fantastic films released in 1999. This is by the Shout Out Louds.